When I was an undergraduate, I lived in Kenmore Square in a fraternity. And fraternities are known for young men getting together and not using their judgment extremely well. One of the things that we did was we got some surgical tubing, went up to the roof of our fraternity house, and started launching chili peppers across the square. That's actually part of the culture of MIT, is hacks and rowdiness and whatnot. Actually, we were trying to estimate the parabolic trajectory of the peppers, that's true. But there were students from Boston University in our vicinity, and we were mostly seeing if we could annoy them.
In many ways, Dr. Jack Collins is still launching chili peppers into the crowd today. After getting his bachelor's degree in computer science and his master's in systems engineering, he made an interesting turn in his career. He got two more postgraduate theology degrees, and he became a professor at Covenant Theological Seminary in Missouri, where he's an expert on the language and history of the Old Testament. Not surprisingly, he's used all of this academic training to write about the intersection of faith and science. I'm Nathan Barzee of the Octet Collaborative, and this is Infinite Corridor, the podcast that tells stories of faith in the lives, past and present, of the MIT community.
Well, I've always been fascinated with the world of nature. Biological systems, physics, engineering, all of those things have fascinated me. And after my conversion, I began to realize that fascination, that enjoyment was a good thing, because these things that I was interested in were the gifts of a good creator, and that the ability to study these things was quite the privilege. I would never advocate that a person feel that they're less than a dedicated Christian by being in the sciences. The sciences and engineering, all of these things are good studies, and they can serve human well-being, but they also can express curiosity and wonder, and that's also good. And then finally, they can also, as necessary, provide us with tools for addressing our own doubts or the doubts of people that we are around, doubts that might even keep people away from Christian faith.
Jack is the author of 6 books, and he's the Old Testament chairman of the English Standard Version Study Bible. He's published numerous materials about the Old Testament book of Genesis, the first book in the Bible, and 3 books about science and faith. But initially, he planned for a career in engineering.
I studied at MIT. My bachelor's was in 1976, and my master's was in 1978. And then I worked for consulting firms in Cambridge for the next several years, especially Bolt, Baranek, and Newman in Fresh Pond, working as an engineer, doing signal processing engineering. And then in 1981, I started seminary, studied for a Master of Divinity. Then after that, I did a PhD in Hebrew linguistics over in England. When I came back to the States in 1989, I planted a church in Spokane, Washington, and I've been teaching at Covenant Seminary since January of 1993. So it's not a surprise that with a background like that, issues of science and faith would be pretty important to me. They've always been of interest, and my systems engineering background did help me in the study of the biblical languages, at least initially, for sure. Because the way they're normally taught for adults in seminary is you have charts, you have lists, and so forth. It's very analytical. And so the engineering process of analyzing and problem solving was extremely helpful.
Many Christians can be concerned that science undermines the Bible. So, 20 years ago, Jack wrote a book called Science and Faith, Friends or Foes. In this book, Jack applies the biblical teaching on creation to the areas where there is perceived conflict between faith and science, including the age of the earth, evolution, miracles, and he explains what claims each side has concerning truth. He wrote this book because of his own experience.
When I started at MIT, I was nominally Christian, but I had not really seriously grappled with the issues of my faith. And so my lifestyle, my first year and a half, was really a rejection of that nominal Christianity. But then I came to a genuine faith in the middle of my second year in December of 1973. And that was in the context of a parachurch ministry. And most parachurch ministries are not heavily theological, and they're also very task-oriented. And this one was all of the above. And so as I began to experience things like I liked what I was studying, especially as a graduate student, I didn't know if that was okay with God for me to enjoy my studies. And then as I was working in a consulting firm and having a lot of satisfaction with solving all kinds of problems, was that okay with God, or was that in competition with my loyalty to God? These are theological questions that I really didn't have any tools or resources for answering. And so I began looking farther afield, and I discovered that there is really a theological richness in the Christian heritage that I knew nothing about. And so I began reading, especially from the Reformation period and the post-Reformation period, and I realized I needed to learn more just to keep my feet on the ground as a Christian. And my initial goal in going to seminary was just to do like a 2-year Master of Arts type of degree in order to get those tools and then to return and to finish an engineering PhD. That was my original plan. But as I got into the theological studies and especially the biblical studies, I found myself captivated. And I guess that's sort of what has driven me for most of my life since then, is making sure that my answers to those kinds of questions will really stand up under scrutiny.
What Jack found was that an understanding of biblical studies, and even the details of biblical Hebrew, was important to the ongoing debate about the age of the earth, as described in the creation account found in Genesis. This debate raises several key questions about biblical authority, about how to interpret Genesis, about the relationship between scientific and theological knowledge. Same thing with the Bible's claim that a real Adam and Eve truly existed. So, Jack became an expert in Hebrew in part to understand these modern controversies. Here, he explains the way that his engineering background changed his approach to the ancient languages of the Bible.
Stephen Hawking, in his Brief History of Time, says that every equation that he includes in the book loses half his audience. So I'm trying to be mindful of exactly that phenomenon here. But you have data in Hebrew, the words in the Hebrew Bible, but you also have other things related to the Hebrew Bible. You have other samples of ancient Hebrew, a small number of samples. You have a lot more samples of later stages of Hebrew. But you also have languages that are related to Hebrew. These are all called Semitic languages. So the particular questions I was looking at had to do with the relationship of the Hebrew dictionary to the dictionaries of these other languages and the other stages of Hebrew. So that is basically an empirical study. So understanding how do you do an empirical study, what constitutes a sufficiently large data set. There are some words, say, in the Hebrew dictionary that only show up a few times. So you can't really make meaningful generalizations there, but I had to come up with a number like 20 occurrences or something like that that gave me the opportunity to make meaningful generalizations and meaningful empirical conclusions. And I also wanted to find, okay, are there patterns and so on? So, I mean, the very notion that I would look at the data and analyze it looking for something that was statistically meaningful, looking for patterns and so forth. A lot of this came to me from my systems engineering background.
That book that Jack wrote 20 years ago, Science and Faith, Friends or Foes, he opens it with an illustration about his toddler daughter's lack of fear to pet a python in a pet store. He writes that this is a parable for the way many Christians approach science with fear. This fear can come because science classes in school were hard, or because well-known science writers such as Richard Dawkins or Carl Sagan or Bill Nye are hostile to Christianity. But he says, if we have a proper grasp of Christian theology, then we should love the natural world and respect the study of it, confident that God's word can hold up under any scientific challenge.
So the python illustration, I was recollecting an instance in which my daughter and I went to a pet shop. There was a young man there who was holding a snake. It was a very small snake, actually, so it was a very young python. and he was showing it to these two teenage boys. And the boys were jostling with each other, elbowing each other. Okay, you go ahead and touch it. You touch it. And neither of them could get up the courage to touch the serpent. And they were trying to challenge each other's manliness, which was, to me, hilarious, because then my daughter, tiny little girl, I think she was about two or so, asked if she could pet the snake. And she just reached right up and she was perfectly fine with it. The reason I use that illustration is for a lot of Christians, their attitude towards the sciences is as if this baby python is some dangerous animal that is going to swallow them and everybody they love. Whereas really, it's something that God has put on this earth for us to enjoy. And actually, most pythons can be fairly tame. They actually settle down fairly quickly. My daughter has always been interested in living things. When she was an undergraduate, she became fascinated with bats. So she worked in a lab with one of the leading experts in the world in bats and became very concerned with a particular disease that is spreading amongst bats on the East Coast called white nose syndrome. It can lead to bats dying. She now lives in South America and she goes on batting expeditions as a volunteer. And she has made some discoveries, particular species of bats that nobody ever knew were in the region where she is. And she's devoted to that. And she's devoted to conservationism as well, in a way that makes me very proud. So I think people who read the book found some help in it. But from the point of view of somebody who's interested in good critical thinking and good critical communication, I have found the last several years very frustrating. People in the sciences are not very good at explaining why they hold the views that they do. One of the principles I've tried to apply and urge my students to apply is something I learned very early on in math. You show your work. Explain to people how you got to the answer that you did. And then, of course, by showing your work, you expose yourself to critical review. That can be risky, but that's part of what it means to communicate from one person to another person. And in our larger culture, we want to accord a lot of authority or credibility to the sciences, which I think is a good motivation on our part. But if the people who are the spokespersons for the sciences don't show their work, but simply tell us to believe them, and so they're exercising coercion, that's not really bringing people along. And that's one of the things I wanted to do in that book, was to show my work as much as I could. At the same time, what we need on the receiving end is a lot more willingness to listen to an open conversation. And so you see people spreading a lot of distrust of the scientists and the sciences. It really is a two-way street. I'm not trying to lay blame at anybody's feet exclusively. I think there's plenty to go around. I have tried as much as possible, you know, in private conversations and so forth, to try to help people develop a level of what's called intellectual virtue, the ability to think things through responsibly and then to communicate responsibly. And I wish that that were more widely spread.
Now, as you're listening to Jack, what's probably coming to mind is current debates about science and policy. COVID, climate change, that sort of thing. But remember, when he was first asking these questions, he was asking, how can we compare an ancient text, like the Hebrew Bible, to scientific experiments that are conducted and replicated today? How could a trained scientist like Jack have any faith in the accuracy of ancient manuscripts?
I have encountered people, in fact, people that I went to MIT with, who said, oh, you can't believe the Bible because it's been copied and translated so many different times that you don't even know whether you're anywhere near what the original writers actually said. Now, that's an example of people saying things that they haven't really analyzed. So I recognize that as an empirical statement. That is to say, can you back that up with evidence from any kind of study of scribal practices, of ancient texts, and so forth? Well, it turns out the tools for doing that have been developed over quite a few centuries. people have been interested in making sure they have the authentic text of, say, the classical writers, Plato and Aristotle. So they develop tools for the science that is called textual criticism. That is to say, you're evaluating a particular reading and you're asking yourself, well, do I have good reasons for believing that this is what the ancient author actually wrote? So you have these tools that have been developed not simply for the Bible, but for all ancient authors. When it comes to the biblical texts, we have plenty of evidence to show us that we have largely very, very accurate transmission. There are scribal practices, say, for the Hebrew Bible that are very, very demanding. You have professionally trained scribes. These are not people doing something in their garage in their spare time. These are people doing this textual copying as a professional activity and a highly learned activity. And we have ancient copies of the Hebrew Bible going back 1,000 years for a full manuscript, and portions of manuscripts going back even farther than that. And so we have good grounds for confidence there. Plus, then we also have a tradition of interpretation, and we have linguistic study and so forth to make sure that we're understanding the language that the original writers wrote in. In fact, that was my own doctoral research, was one of those tools for studying the ancient meanings of the Hebrew language and trying to make sure that we were doing it right.
So there's a topic that we've been circling here. Let's get specific now about what the Bible has to say about the origins of humanity. If you're not familiar with the Bible, one thing you should know is that it's primarily a book of revelation about God's work of redemption in a fallen world. At the same time, Christians believe that the Bible expresses truth. So, how do we understand those truths alongside of the truth that we get from science, particularly when that science is always developing?
The question of the origins and the initial population size of human beings, that's a good illustration of how science is revising itself, which it should do. So one has to be very careful there about talking about settled science or scientific facts. In the 1990s, for example, as people were beginning to study the human genome, they began to recognize that there were distinctive features, apparently, of contributions from the Neanderthals in the genome of modern humans. This was back in 1996 or 97. The story was becoming that anybody who has ginger hair, that's a contribution of the Neanderthals. Well, you can't tell now, but I was a ginger back then. That was a view that lasted for a little while, but I think it's gone out of favor. Then you get the report of the Human Genome Project under Francis Collins, who's not related to me so far as I know. You're beginning to be able to say, okay, so you have components in the human genome that look like they are holdovers from our ancestors, you know, pre-human ancestors. At the time, they were describing many of those holdovers as junk DNA. That is to say, it had no function. A few years later, Francis Collins himself was acknowledging that the term junk DNA was a mistake, because they are now finding lots of functions for those portions of your DNA. But it also looks like you have contributions in the genomes of certain ethnicities. So like my ancestry is European, and so most Europeans have contributions from the Neanderthals, a small percentage of contribution in our DNA, at least that's the current thinking. And then in other parts, say in Russia and parts of Asia, you have contributions from a similar group from the Denisovan caves and so on and so forth. And they were saying then that people of African descent don't have any of that, but now that's also changing. So these analyses are being updated, as they should be. So the mistake is not that people are saying these things, but they act as if these are final. Then, and this is in Francis Collins's book, that in the study of human DNA and the human genome, it looks like you can't get the diversity that we have in the modern population from an initial population of only two. So people were saying that as an established fact. It turns out that it isn't quite an established fact. It depends on how recently you need those ancestors to go back. And so there was actually a big dust-up. There's a geneticist from England named Richard Buggs who has done his own research. And Buggs is arguing, actually, if you go back far enough, like 500,000 years, these difficulties begin to disappear. More recently, a theologian named William Lane Craig is building on that and is arguing, well, if you go back even further, then all the apparent difficulties can be taken care of. I say all this not so as to say that we have settled this question, but rather to say, well, there's a lot of ways you can deal with some of these things. I mean, the science is going to keep moving, as it should. It's going to keep developing. The biblical material is capable of matching a number of different scenarios with the sciences, because the biblical material, especially in Genesis, uses a pictorial presentation. Pictorial doesn't mean untrue, and it doesn't mean unhistorical. One can affirm with Genesis and with Paul that we have this common ancestry in Adam and Eve without being somehow embarrassed that the science is going to make us look ridiculous. But exactly what that's going to look like, you can come up with different scenarios. And those scenarios will, if you're willing to go back as far as Dr. Craig goes, 750,000 years or even a million years, that's one way of going about it. Or if you prefer something far more recent, as some groups do, you will assess these based on the intellectual costs and the benefits. So the cost of going that far back, as Dr. Craig does, is the discomfort. Like, that's an awfully long way back. And it seems like you're creating other problems in order to solve this problem. So I look at it as an engineer. I look at it as a system. And I'm looking at the optimization of the whole system. And what you have to do is trade-offs. If you come more recent, well, you can pay the price of criticizing a lot of the genomic studies in order to get a single set of ancestors. And there are people who are willing to do that. Or you can work within that and talk about a small number of ancestors with an Adam and Eve as, say, the king and the queen and so forth. But you're paying a price if you're willing to do that. And for some people, they don't want to pay that price of a number that's larger than two. So what I've tried to do is to lay out the scenarios and then give people the tools for doing the cost-benefit analysis. I mean, I belong to a particular denomination, so we have our preferences and so on. But if I'm speaking to the wider Christian world or even to the wider world of people who aren't Christians yet, I want to say, look, there's a set of possibilities. Then you have the opportunity and, as it were, the responsibility to sort through these opportunities based on what you perceive to be the costs and the benefits. But under no circumstances are you entitled to say that the biblical picture has been falsified by the science. It hasn't. When people use the science to argue that the biblical picture has been falsified, they're either being unfair with the science or unfair with the Bible, or maybe both. And I think if you're fair with them both, then you can live with a level of uncertainty, but also proceed with proper and entitled level of confidence in the biblical material.
In the summer of 2017, scientists recovered DNA from 3,500-year-old bones belonging to an ancient people group called the Canaanites, who lived in what's now modern-day Lebanon. The team then compared this ancient DNA with the sequenced genomes of 99 modern people living in the same region. The study found that the modern Lebanese people shared about 93% of their ancestry with the Bronze Age Canaanite samples. And because the Old Testament contains passages that say that the Canaanites were annihilated, this was presented as another example of the Bible containing historical inaccuracies.
The 2017 study about the Canaanites is a fascinating piece of work, fascinating for a lot of reasons. One is that the authors of the study itself actually introduced this whole subject of, and that falsifies the Bible, because the Bible says the Canaanites were wiped out. I was stunned at that because I encountered it, like everybody did, through the science reporters. And my first interest was the sociological one. Why are all the reporters saying exactly the same thing? And why is there no curiosity whatsoever on the part of these journalists? It is true that you will find in Lebanon Canaanite ancestry, and that that's fully compliant with the biblical picture, because the Phoenicians, that's the ancestral population of Lebanon, those were the Canaanites who left the land of Canaan as the Israelites came in. So it is no surprise to find Canaanite ancestry in the people of Lebanon, and it's no challenge to the Bible whatsoever. And as a matter of fact, the biblical materials do not suggest that even the Canaanites who remained in the land were wiped out entirely. A number of them were allowed to remain, in some cases because they converted to worshiping the God of Israel. In other cases, simply because the Israelites couldn't be bothered to engage them. And so, you know, just the whole portrayal of that as somehow proving the Bible wrong, I thought that that was a product of the journalists, but it was actually a product of the scientists who wrote the original paper. And that, in my view, is an irresponsible move on their part. What it's going to take is somebody who knows something of the science and something of the Bible, then to look at it and to try to guide people through the proper analysis.
Through many years of writing and speaking, Jack has received a lot of feedback on his work. But he has a favorite anecdote about his book, Science and Faith.
I actually contributed to Marriage Enrichment for some very good friends of mine with that book. He's a PhD in physics from MIT days, both undergraduate and graduate school there. Like all of us, kind of a nerd in a good way. I mean, that's nothing but good for us. But his wife doesn't live in his world, and she's always felt like a foreigner to his world. And then she read my book, and she said, "I finally understand my husband." She told me it was like I was sitting down at their kitchen table explaining stuff. That's my favorite anecdote.
I'm Nathan Barzi, and this is the Infinite Corridor Podcast, a production of the Octet Collaborative, a Christian study center serving MIT. This episode was recorded, written, and edited by Carolyn McCulley, with production assistance from Cam Jones. It was supported by Upper House and the Templeton Foundation. To learn more about the Octet Collaborative, visit us at octetcollaborative.org. That's OCTET collaborative.org. Thanks for listening.